You're listening to a message brought to you by Christian Life Church Hereford. If you would like to find out more about us, go to www.clch.cc.
So guys, Llewellyn said last week, we're looking at Hebrews 11, and this is God's Hall of Fame, and I had a choice. Andrew said you can do Noah or you could do Rahab, and I'm like, oh, Noah. Noah is a much more exciting story. So today, to introduce the man. So first, I'd like to observe, it's never too late to be used by the Lord. Anybody who feels a little bit old and tired today, Noah was 500 years old, and that was before he started having children, and the story begins. So there is hope for all of us. 450 left to go then. Oh, fantastic. Exactly. Oh, lovely. According to my favourite Old Testament scholar, John Walton, Noah was not his real name. It's a title given by the ancient Hebrews to this heroic figure who survived a flood and saved the world. And the title means, this one will bring rest. More of this in a bit. So he's the first person God uses mightily in the Bible. And someone observed, he's the only person in the Bible to survive the end of the world. Now, I, as an analyst, would like to say, well, that's not strictly true because he had seven other people with him. But still, as I mulled over, there may be something to learn from Noah in these days about surviving the end of the world. And I wanted to start by digging a little into the context of the story. How would the ancient Hebrews have understood Noah and his faith? As like all these early stories, this is a highly symbolic tale. And I'm going to take three of the major images, the flood, the ark, and the rainbow, as a starting point. So the flood. The story of a great flood that wipes out the world is seen in more than one ancient near Middle Eastern text. And it seems likely that it was a real event in very ancient history. And the flood narratives, as told in Genesis, tell us why Yahweh brings the floodwaters and then what he did afterwards. And the authors wish to say something about Yahweh's character and actions, and they wish to highlight that these characteristics were in contrast with others of the flood narratives. So, looking broadly across the book of Genesis as we move towards the flood story, we first see God walking in the cool of the evening with the people that he created out of love, Adam and Eve. And then the fall happens, and the earth is filled with Hamas, which means violence in ancient Hebrew and shouldn't be, and apparently has no etymological connection with the Arab word that we see today. So in the fall, the Nephilim walk the earth. And people seem to know an awful lot about the Nephilim these days, even though they're not mentioned that much. But the harmony and the shalom that was originally on all of God's creation in the garden is lost. And the flood is then portrayed as the reversal of creation. God is angry, and the flood wipes out this violence by wiping out the people who committed it. But the creation has not been permanently undone. In faith, Noah follows God's commandments and brings back the order that was originally seen in Eden. So here is the title, Noah, as the one who brings rest, describing the person chosen to re-establish God's order and bring peace back to the earth. So then, the ark. The design of the ark is specified in Genesis 6. It gives its size and what it is made of and the windows and doors that it must have. Interestingly, exactly the same size, the ark is exactly the same size as the temple Solomon will be asked to build in Jerusalem. So you can see all these symbolic things that flow through the Old Testament. However, if you look at what was actually specified, it's missing a few things. What Noah built wasn't really a proper boat. It had no rudder, no sail, no outboard motor, giving Noah no way to influence where it went. It was more like a floating bathtub, completely given over to the providence of God. So how would the readers of Genesis have understood the symbolism of the ark? First of all, it was a symbol of God's guidance and the care for the people he loves. It was also a means of deliverance and salvation in the world. There are also some more complicated images of the ark being like Eden. It is a peaceful place where all the animals live in harmony, which is probably a good thing. And also, as already noted, the Ark is symbolically related to the temple in Jerusalem, a place where God's image rested and could be accessed by his people. So then, the rainbow. Then Noah built an ark, an altar to the Lord. And taking some of all the clean animals and the clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of the humans. Even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all the living creatures as I have done." So on leaving the ark, Noah's first act is to build the very first altar and to offer a sacrifice of thanks and praise to God. And God is pleased with this and enters into a covenant or a promise with him. This is the first covenant between God and man. There are four more, typically, noted by scholars. And God promises that he will never again destroy the earth and all its people. And the rainbow is a sign of this covenant. So, looking across the story of Noah and all of the symbolism, what did the faith of one of our heroes from Hebrews 11 do exactly? First of all, despite being 500 years old and probably in need of a sit-down, Noah is asked to spend 120 years building a giant bathtub the size of the future temple of Jerusalem. This determined effort to fulfill what God has asked of him saves the world and re-establishes God's order and the shalom over it. And when he steps out onto the dry land, he creates a pleasing sacrifice which changes God's heart and leads him to promise never to destroy the world again. So, what can we learn from Noah? So many hard things. I'm just warning you, you may be required to fasten your seatbelts. This is going to be a bumpy ride. I decided to tackle just two areas. First, how do I become the one person on the whole planet that God trusts with saving the world? And then, how do I get from being the suitable person of faith to building a boat? First question, how do I become the one person on the planet who God trusts with saving the world? So, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. First of all, Noah was righteous. What is righteous? In the Old Testament, it's about conforming to God's will and keeping the laws. In the New Testament, it changes, particularly in the letters of Paul. It becomes about being in right standing with God through faith. My righteousness with God comes from believing the promises, believing in Jesus and believing the promises. Relatively straightforward. Second, Noah was blameless. Biblical commentaries say that it's not a term frequently applied to people in the Bible. It's more about sacrifices being blameless. When used, the Hebrew word tamim usually refers to someone whose actions were consistent with their values and who remains true to their commitments, but does not imply that they are perfect or blameless. Indeed, the complete picture of Noah's life shows that it is characterized by some less good moments. See the end of the story where he gets drunk and misplaces his clothing. And then lastly, Noah walked with God. So Noah was righteous, like all the Israelites at that time were meant to be. He was blameless, a goal achieved by a few in the Old Testament, and he walked with God, a state only reached by Enoch and one or two others. To walk with God means we choose to glorify him in every way that we can, regardless of the personal cost. We choose the narrow path over the broad path. There are certain things we choose not to do. Walking with God means we might choose not to walk with certain people. And ultimately, walking with God requires letting go of all the things that are a distraction in our life. So how does Noah get to be chosen by God? He chooses to believe. He remains true to these beliefs and he walks them out. He makes life choices which are hard. It almost makes one think that it might be easier if God didn't appear and ask us to build an ark, I feel. So, an an interesting contrast. I'm going back into a little bit of history with one of the other heroes of another flood account. So in the Gilgamesh, which is the Mesopotamian, so Iranian mythology, humans were created to serve gods, but their growing numbers and the noise that all of these people made disturbed the gods. And as someone who lives on a hill because it's peaceful and quiet, I kind of understand the gods' point of view, I feel. So this is Utnapishtim and his wife. Rather a nice picture, rather a nice couple, I reckon. And he is portrayed as being the hero of one of the other, this flood narrative. Who, like Noah, was obedient to the gods, but he saves the world by being cunning. It's a very long story, and I decided not to go through it. But the gods were rather capricious, and you never knew quite what they were going to do. And so Utnapishtim had to sneak round and save the world by doing things while the gods weren't looking. So comparing these two heroes, Noah's choice to be faithful and to trust God makes his actions in the flood story the foundations of a new order under a one just God, rather than having to trick a range of frankly not very nice gods. And he makes good choices and God honours these. He doesn't need to resort to his own strength to save the world. Of course, one begins to think of all the things we think we should do and how we're going to do them in our own strength. You know, just the way life is, the way we're built, really. And so my last slide. How do I get from having faith and being in a right place with God to taking action? By faith, Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. And those of us who were with Laurie when she was here with us on Tuesday, she talked about the end times. And as she was speaking, it got me thinking about the flood story and about the key part of Noah's faith, this kind of holy fear. So this is not reverence and awe. This is not terror. This is not terror. This is about reverence and awe before God's authority. Now, Charlotte, do I spend any time thinking with holy fear about Jesus' return and whether I am ready? That was what I was thinking when Laurie was speaking. And I went, well, no, not really. No. Strangely, over the last 6 months, I've felt called to pray for a better understanding of the awesomeness of God. But I have to be honest, I haven't really had any major breakthroughs. But if I did, and I had a sense of the true holy fear, what would it be like? Well, I'd be ready to do crazy things in the eyes of the world. So, Lord, just to clarify, you want me to spend 120 years building a giant floating bathtub just in case it rains so much that everybody else drowns. I'm then going to have to get into this bathtub and float around without any way of influencing where I'm going for an unspecified amount of time until you rescue me. Oh, yes, Lord. So in holy fear, Noah, knowing almost nothing about God's plans, chooses to follow God's instructions. Taking this action requires him to trust. Number one, in a bigger picture, a plan to prosper him and the world and not to harm him. Two, that he'd be given the diverse range of skills that he would be needed, boat building, animal care, performance of priestly duties that are pleasing to God. And then three, he trusted God to not forget him and the rest of the world floating around aboard the ark. So how do we translate this into our lives? It's easy to see and say in vague terms, you know, use me, Lord. But what if Lord has not given you a clear vision of the one bathtub that you're meant to build? I was thinking it might be about not shrinking back from the hard bits of life and practicing new ways to lean on our faith from day to day. My sister is a very strict traditional Catholic, she often talks about everyday life as being required to pick up our cross and follow me. And our cross is not just this slightly Catholic idea of us having to find a way to live with the inevitable and the burdens of life. It's that symbol of, you know, what we have to do and what we're called to do. We would like to shed all of these pieces. It would be so nice if they went away, but because they are painful and difficult. But they're actually forming our character, and they even give us opportunities to get closer to God. There's something about God's plans, however painful. So I thought I would just offer us a 2-minute guided prayer to think about this, to give us time to hear God talk to us about what he wants from our lives. So if I may, I'm just going to start by praying, and then I'm going to leave you with some little ideas just to think through. And so Lord, we come before you now and acknowledge that you are an awesome God. And we ask you to come close and speak to us about your good plans to prosper us. What could we do that would please you in the coming weeks? I just want to know, what is the first thing that God pops into your mind when you think about the tasks he has for you? Ask him why this is important and ask for more clarity. Ask him if he wants you to take action. And just ask him if there's anything important around that action, that the way in which you perform it. And also ask him if there are things that he wants you to leave on one side. Is he giving you a picture of something that seems really vital, but perhaps with heavenly perspective, it isn't? Then finally, ask him for a word or a picture or a Bible verse. This might be about the task he's assigned you, but it might also be for somebody else. So we could just ask the Lord to just speak to us now. And then if the word is for somebody else, do let us know. Thank you.